From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar. In this week's special edition of CPR Sunday, we take a trip out to Cleveland in advance of this week's Republican convention, speaking with the Green Party's 2004 presidential candidate, David Cobb, and election watchdog lawyer Bob Fitrakis, describing some current litigation with respect to the Democratic primary, which apparently is not yet settled. And then we close with a discussion with Professor Tony Montero, our regular contributor, about the conventions and the election in general going forward. David Cobb is a lawyer from Texas who was the 2004 Green Party candidate for president. We spoke with him from Cleveland via Skype Saturday. What's the view like from where you are?
Well, let me tell you, it's a hyper-militarized, highly corporatized city. There is no doubt that we are living in corporate-occupied territory here in Cleveland, Don. And I'm here representing Move to Amend, a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition of groups and individuals who are building a mass movement to abolish the illegitimate court-created concept of corporate constitutional rights and get money out of elections. And one of the things that's very interesting is watching how people across the political spectrum, liberals, conservatives, moderates alike, are reacting to how corporatized this political convention is and the disgust they have with the wealthy and powerful here. It's a very interesting phenomenon, Don.
And you know, the city that you're in now, as militarized as it is, used to be run by Dennis Kucinich, didn't it?
That's right. Dennis was the boy mayor, and he got his start in his 20s as a city council member and then mayor. Thanks to Dennis Kucinich, the city of Cleveland actually was able to have publicly controlled electrical power generation and distribution. Now, however, it really is controlled by corporate Democrats. So it's a different city than it once was.
And they shoot like young children that are playing outside like 3 seconds after
they shoot young children, specifically young black children. Absolutely. I mean, there is a horrible, horrible legacy here. However, I can also tell you there is a level of resistance that I'm encountering. For example, today, all day, I participated along with many others in a People's Convention for Justice and Peace. And this brought together people who were working on environmental activism, social justice, racial justice, economic justice issues, creating a highly participatory process by which people are coming together to draft platform planks to say we reject both the Democratic and Republican Party processes and platforms and are making a people's platform. And I got to tell you, Don, that Pacifica listeners would be very impressed by that people's platform process.
Why don't you give us a couple of the kernels that are sort of being floated there?
Well, for example, political justice. There is a call for an entire new constitutional framework because the current constitution is a property rights document. And instead, we need a new legal system that protects and enshrines human rights and the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of nature. There is a call to abolish corporate constitutional rights. There is a call to have access to the ballot and to the debate process for all political parties and independent candidates. There is a call for full publicly funded elections. There is a call for instant runoff voting and proportional representation. There is a call to end felony disenfranchisement because of the racist nature of both our criminal justice system and elections. What I just described to you, Don, in a thumbnail sketch is one of the planks, the political justice plank, that would actually take seriously the idea that the United States of America is supposed to be a democratic republic. If that were true, then our elections should actually be democratic. So that platform process, it took all day for activists and social change agents coming together to grapple together. But that participatory process came forward with a series of demands that we are now going to be taking into the electoral process. In other words, we're no longer trying to lobby elected officials, no longer chasing after candidates. Now we're actually building our own set of demands, taking it to them and telling candidates for office and elected officials, from now on, you have to respond to us. We're not responding to you anymore.
Along those lines, one of the things that is obviously different this year, here in the United States and really across the world, I mean, people have been in the street in France, for example, for many months. You saw Brexit, you see all these things happening all over the world. But here in the United States, you've had the working class basically on its feet, stumbling, trying to find its way in the dark, perhaps, but represented fully in the electoral process behind both Trump and Sanders. And a response from the elites to tamp it down everywhere they can. A unity of the Republican and Democratic establishment behind Clinton, Sanders being forced to essentially endorse Clinton and go hat in hand in order to have a place at the podium at the Democratic convention, despite exit polls saying he should have actually had a first ballot victory. There are people that are looking at the way the Greens dealt with what happened to Ralph Nader in 2000 and really what actually happened in the year 2000, and saying that the safe state strategy in 2004 may have been appropriate then, but perhaps there should be an unsafe state strategy now, where the Greens and progressives target Hillary Clinton in swing states. What are your thoughts on that? Because you were the presidential candidate.
Well, first of all, I want to say, Don, as the 2004 candidate, I actually ran hard and ran everywhere.
I know you did. I was talking to you. I know you did.
States, yeah. But I just want to correct it. That I ran hard and ran everywhere. In fact, evidence of that is that I campaigned in Florida, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, and in Ohio, where I am physically right now. Yep. And remember, especially in Ohio, that I was on the ballot and was able to file a recount in Ohio. And if not for the Green Party, George Bush would have not only stolen an election, but nobody would have known it.
At least
because the Green Party was on the ballot, we were able to fight back and build an election integrity movement. Now, let me circle back to this election cycle and tell you this. I believe that it is an opportunity for a growth spurt for both the Green Party and the Libertarian Party like we have never seen before. What we know is, and you are correct, that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both represent insurgent campaigns within the existing political party structure. The leadership of both of those parties did everything they could to undermine, delegitimize, and squash and suppress those insurgent candidates. Of course, Trump ultimately prevailed. Bernie Sanders almost did. In fact, I think that it's fair to say that Bernie Sanders had the Democratic Party's nomination stolen from him by a combination of party hacks and the corporate media. But at the end of the day, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump represent something, a profound dissatisfaction with politics as usual, and that is an example of how the two-party system is beginning to crack before our eyes, Don. You and I have had this conversation before. The two-party system is not going to be able to survive, and I think that it's coming to its end, because here's the second point I want to make about this, and that is that as we watch Hillary Clinton, the corporatist plutocrat that she is, I actually think she may be the last gasp, because I think that the various movements that exist in this country, and I mean Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, Move to Amend, the climate justice movement, the racial justice movement broadly, the calls to abolish the prison industrial complex. I could go down the list of all these movements that you know, because you're a historian and you follow these things, Don. What you know is that these things are more acute. There are more people on the move. There are more people becoming conscious and in motion than you and I have ever seen in our lifetime. Here's the kicker. Those movements cannot be contained and controlled within the existing Democratic Party. At the end of the day, those movements are either going to destroy, transform the Democratic Party as it exists, or they're going to destroy it. I suspect it's the latter, because I don't think that the Wall Street corporatists are going to let it go. And I think that we are maybe watching the last gasp during this election cycle. And that's the reason I believe that the Green Party's role ought to be not only to welcome Sanders supporters, but to also articulate a red, green, black view of how electoral politics, red for social justice and the great proud tradition of organized labor and socialism, green for deep ecology and the new vision that the Green Party has, and black unapologetically to describe our opposition to white supremacy and our to promote and lift up the need for black and brown liberation. And the Green Party should be the electoral arm of all of these movements.
I couldn't agree with you more. David Kopp, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing you when I get to Cleveland on Tuesday.
All right, man. Look me up. Good to hear your voice.
Bob Fitrakis is an Ohio lawyer based in Columbus who is currently in Cleveland for the convention. He represents a plaintiff that's suing Edison Media Research, Inc., a New Jersey corporation that conducted exit polls in Ohio, in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, New Hampshire, Vermont, Virginia, South Carolina, Wisconsin, New York, Indiana, Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, Connecticut, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Nebraska, and West Virginia during this year's presidential primary elections. The lawsuit details that the exit polls varied dramatically with the vote that was published officially on primary day. In many cases, in 12 states in particular, it exceeded the level that the U.S. State Department uses to measure whether or not an election elsewhere was free and fair. The lawsuit details the fact that after seeing the official tally in each case, Edison Media Research modified its exit poll so that it conformed to the official tally. After looking to see if the process was transparent in order to measure the accuracy of the revisions, they were rebuffed and brought the lawsuit. We spoke with Bob Fitrakis about that via Skype from Cleveland Saturday. Bob Fitrakis, very interesting lawsuit. Let's hear a description.
Well, really, we're suing Edison Research Group, arguing that they're working in collaboration or colluding with the secretaries of state in various states to adjust the polls so we don't get an accurate total for who really won the election.
Yeah, it seems that apparently in a number of states, the exit polls that they were conducting with the full assistance of the state authorities, permission to be near the polling stations and all of that, that the exit polls showed one thing at one time, and then after the official count came out, they were revised. And what you're looking for is some transparency, and they're refusing it, right?
Right. We'd really like to see how the exit polls, which are the international gold standards for detecting election fraud, why this company or how it is adjusting them and simply assuming that the official vote total is correct as opposed to their samples. And again, normally you could say that the official vote total would be correct if they were actually transparent and verifiable. But since partisan for-profit corporations using proprietary software count our votes and they don't meet any minimum standard of transparency, by collaborating like this, by assuming a non-transparent voting system, which has been privatized, is accurate, essentially, you don't know. Either these people are, to some extent, done the most incompetent exit pollers and social scientists on earth, or someone is involved in doctoring and defrauding our election.
Yeah, let me frame this for listeners a little bit. Before we had all these black box voting machines, You could physically verify, if it were necessary, as it became necessary, who voted for whom, but each ballot, who was selected on those ballots. You had a piece of paper, whether it was a roll or a physical ballot, that could be examined and audited and recounted against whatever automatic mechanism was used for tallying. And with these machines, you don't. You, as you put it last time we spoke, it's like a push and pray. So the problem now is that on the other end of it, you've had exit polling and the results, you know, known to people, and then a substantial vector between what the exit polls showed at the beginning and the count, and then a revision of the exit polls, and no transparency about how that happens at all for any of it.
Yeah, now we'd really like to look at their methodology, their samples. We'd like them to explain how they were 36 percentage points off in Arizona, a 10 percentage points off in Ohio, is that in 12 states, the results are so improbable, if those states were nation states, the world community would not recognize them as valid elections.
Yeah, I mean, this is a science. You've said that the U.S. State Department uses a 5% vector as the standard as to whether or not to certify an election.
Yeah, the U.S. State Department and the Agency on International Development, I mean, they write books and pamphlets on this stuff, using the exit polls as the best single detector of fraud.
If one were looking to, you know, for a remedy in terms of how the primaries get actualized at the conventions, of course, you'd have to reach into the delicate certification process that goes on at the conventions. And in particular, we're talking here primarily about Clinton and Sanders and a condition where the exit polls would have show that Sanders should have had enough delegates to win on a first ballot victory. And instead, he doesn't and is, you know, making political statements of concession right now. You know, if you're what you're looking for in terms of this process would be evidence for something that would reach into the convention. How would that work?
Well, the convention itself appears, based on the exit polls, to be nominating the wrong person. And more than that, I mean, my preference is that there should be a criminal investigation. You know, I'm not accusing the Clinton campaign of, you know, systematically stealing elections. But if you look at the stripping of the voter rolls, which is also done with computerized poll books and electronic computerized control of the voter databases, is somebody, I don't know who it is, what party, what motives, is clearly stealing votes, repressing Sanders voters, and then in at least 12 of these states, flipping votes as needed. So, you know, I would prefer a criminal investigation. I think there should be a massive floor fight. My suit is probably a little too late that may impact the November election in terms of what can and can't be done. But there should be a major floor fight over the question of democracy and how somebody gets nominated that's clearly there by fraud.
You know, it seems that the rules, of course, would be looking to the official vote count as being the final arbiter of how someone gets seated there, along with the individual criteria for each of the delegates. But the certified vote count, of course, places Clinton ahead of Sanders, although not in a position for a first ballot victory without the so-called superdelegates. With a floor fight and with a full vetting of this chicanery in front of the convention, do you think there's any chance that it could impact the outcome of what happens in Philadelphia?
Well, it could. But it really depends upon the willingness of the Sanders people to push the extremes, and also what is logical, that they're entitled to far more delegates than they were granted. So with their candidate endorsing Clinton, that could be problematic. But if people were just concerned not with an individual candidate, but the principle of representation and democracy, they've got more than enough evidence to reassign delegates and credential them. My understanding, though, the exact opposite is going on. The Clinton people that are often more veteran party activists and, you know, deal with the boards of elections and registrars are, in fact, decredentialing Sanders people. So instead of getting the delegates he deserves to be nominated, he's getting less than probably he won in a crooked vote count.
And finally, you know, going forward, if the litigation is able to uncover this fraud and show some connection between Clinton's campaign and, you know, the illegal activity that produced this result, do you think that should or would have an impact on the outcome of the election?
I think if we show, you know, fraudulent behavior in any way link it to the Clinton campaign, then she should probably resign and Sanders should be nominated. And I think in all likelihood, I can't understand, and I don't know what level it would be at, but I can't understand how she is not aware that she is only there because of the most flagrant stripping of the voter rolls, deregistering Sanders votes at such a high level. It's really in many states, Arizona, Alabama, California, New York, it's a coup d'etat. She's got to be aware that somebody is gaming and manipulating the system in an illegal way. And if that's tied to her campaign, I can't see with the email and some of the other problems how she can remain a viable candidate.
And just for a final point, question, the superdelegates are mostly elected officials and other senior government officials that are affiliated with the party. Does that include the heads of the Board of Elections in many of these states?
Oh, no, absolutely. Because, for example, in Ohio, in my county, Franklin County, the Board of Election director, the executive director, was also for a long period of time the chair of the party. Usually each of the major parties get to nominate in our state the director and the assistant director, depending on whether they won that county or not. And by the way, our chair of the Board of Election in Franklin County, where Columbus is in Ohio, was just arrested, indicted for signing off on a ghost employee at the Board of Elections. So these are the type of people that are controlling the vote.
Bob Fitrakis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Donald Trump has, at least for the moment, a vice presidential candidate in the governor of Indiana, Mike Pence. The Republican convention is about to open, and the Democratic convention will be opening a week from today, more or less. For more on that and everything that's happened and some of the things that have not yet happened, we had a conversation with our regular contributor on political affairs, Professor Tony Montero, via Skype on Friday. Professor Montero, welcome back.
Thank you, Don. How are you today?
I'm doing okay, and I'm looking back over the passing or almost past week at some of the things that have happened. Let's chat about it.
Good, good. You know, I think the thing that really has struck me is the latest New York Times CBS poll that was reported a couple days on the front page of the New York Times, showing that 67% of the voting population say that Hillary Clinton is untrustworthy. and only about 28% say that she is trustworthy. And on top of that, other polls showing that nationally, Clinton and Trump are running even, exactly even, 40% each of the electorate. And in swing states of Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, he's leading or they're tied. And this seems to me to present a real dilemma, an almost existential crisis for the Clinton campaign and for the Democratic Party as it prepares to convene here in Philadelphia in a little over a week. So I think they have some real decisions to make about whether they go with Hillary and what that means, and are they prepared for what would be a very humiliating defeat at the hands of Donald Trump, an insurgent who doesn't have the support of even the Republican Party. So this is some very serious stuff that we're looking at right now.
You know, one real interesting thing that caught my eye, we've been talking about before, is the fact that they're tied at 40% each, which means there's 20% mm-hmm. that are, right. you know, thinking of something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important. And I think it presents a real opportunity for Jill Stein and the Greens to run a 16-state focused campaign in all of the swing states. In other words, to run with the big dogs
right.
and not be concerned with whether or not they claim that she is going to throw the election from the Democrats to Trump. I don't think she should be concerned about that at all. Run with the big dogs and let the chips fall where they may. They're 20% of the electorate right now that are looking for an alternative to Democrats and Republicans. And that's very, very good. But I think the huge thing is that over 25% of Democrats are unhappy with Hillary Clinton as their nominee. I think, and I don't want to be too speculative about this, there is still a possibility that she could not be or would not be the nominee of the Democratic Party.
You know, there's all this litigation that's out there. It's mm-hmm. not, obviously, or in any event, very apparently not being conducted by Sanders, but rather by people who got involved in the Democratic primary with Sanders mm-hmm. because of promises that were made publicly by Deborah Schultz Wasserman and other DNC officials that the process would be fair. And then there's this massive pile of evidence, including the exit polls against the certified vote, that in fact it wasn't fair, it was fixed. Mm-hmm. And there are delegates that are going to be fighting on the floor and perhaps even a legal challenge at the Credentials Committee level to some of Clinton's delegates, that taking place in the context of this polling data and whatever's going on in the streets in Philadelphia. So it may well be a surprise there. But how do they don't want to give it to Sanders if she is if she has to mm-hmm. step aside. How are they going to hand it to, like, I don't know, Biden and Warren or something?
Well, you know, this is very interesting. And as we have talked in the past, you know, the great contradiction is Clinton versus the people, Clinton yeah. versus the Democratic Party voters. And that's a metaphor in some ways for the people versus Wall Street. So once again, we're back to Occupy 4 years, 5 years ago, Occupy Wall Street, the 1% versus the rest of us. And in a standoff at the Democratic Party with upwards of 100,000 or more people in the streets of Philadelphia, protesting on all of the many of the issues, or most of the issues, that Clinton is identified with, including war, economic inequality, fracking, and other things. I think that that anything is possible. Now, if the Wall Streeters, the one percenters, the Clinton backers attempt to impose a Biden-Warren on the convention, I think all hell breaks loose. And you'll have in Philadelphia what Trump was predicting would happen in Cleveland if they tried to deny him the nomination after he won the most votes and most delegates. I think you could possibly see that in the streets of Philadelphia. The people are not in a mood to accept the dictates of Wall Street after they have gone out, organized, fundraised, voted, and exercised a democracy and made democracy real from the bottom up. They're not prepared to see, in the name of defeating Trump, a Biden-Warren ticket. So I think we're dealing with deep and deepening contradictions that have now become antagonistic. And unlike 4 years ago or 5 years ago with Occupy Wall Street, when you had very little organization, now you have organized masses demanding that they be heard and that their will be implemented. So I think this is very important.
Yeah, I think on that point, we have to take into consideration the fact that, you know, Occupy Wall Street started with a handful of kids as a structure. And you have the Bernie Sanders campaign structure. People have the email lists. They have some money even. And and they've been working for a year. They're battle seasoned already. You've got Black Lives Movement, and you've got the same, you know, basically the same apparatus behind Trump, who won massively the Republican primary with spending like a tenth of what the next person above him spent.
And you know, it's so interesting that that Trump and Sanders got approximately the same number of votes.
There
are 26 million people approximately that voted for a political insurgency. If you take the voting, you know, the grid of those who vote, it's like a 110 million people, you know. So we're talking about roughly one fourth, and this is just in the primary, one fourth of the electorate voted for an insurgency. Now, if you take primary voters, Republican and Democrats put together, if you take the total numbers, we're looking at over 50% of those who voted for an insurgency. This is not insignificant. And as you know, you and I have talked over and over again over the weeks, the Bernie and Trump movement have more in common than either of them have with the establishment of their political party, their respective political parties. And certainly either movement has with Hillary Clinton and the Wall Streeters.
Yeah. And as you mentioned last time we spoke, this election cycle may have nested within it another recession coming, and that you know, is not going to operate in favor of whoever is perceived as the establishment candidate, whether it's Clinton or Biden or Warren or some combination thereof.
Yeah, definitely. It's very possible. And you know, under those circumstances, and this is the key thing politically for the left, how to unite forces that are operating separately at this time. The big one is uniting the Trump elements, and that is the white working class. And let me just say parenthetically, I reject the notion that the Trump movement is a fascist movement, and the majority of people in it are out-and-out racists and skinheads and Ku Klux Klan members. That is not the case. The majority of people in the Trump movement are honest working-class people with issues with respect to class consciousness, race, and so on and so forth. But the Trump movement and the Hillary movement, the Sanders movement must find ways of coming together. The Black Lives movement must find ways of uniting with the insurgency within the trade union movement, the dissatisfaction in the Rust Belt, in places like Michigan, in Ohio, in Western Pennsylvania, the rejection of the old trade union leadership, be it the UAW or the leadership of the AFL-CIO itself. Black lives must come together with that, and labor must come together with the Black Lives Movement, and the two political insurgencies must find common ground with Black lives and with the trade union rank-and-file upsurge. The environmental movement and all of these must come together. So we're talking about a new coalition, a new movement, a new action agenda, a new paradigm, which has the objective function of undoing the two-party governing system of this country. What we're looking at is a return, I think, Don, going forward, a return to grassroots politics and organization. I think the country will literally increasingly become ungovernable. And in the absence of the government of the neoliberal elites, a new people's power can emerge. And that's what we have to focus upon.
You know, it's very rare that you have an opportunity to see things in the kind of relief we see them now. In particular,
yes.
You know, we theoretically know that the idea of racism has been perpetuated, mm-hmm. was created and perpetuated yeah. to divide the working class so that one segment mm-hmm. could be super victimized, enslaved, and mm-hmm. all of the things that happened. Mm-hmm. Others bought off with petty privilege that ends up eating at their right. feet. But you never really get to see how the mechanics of that operate. And now that you mm-hmm. see the elite under siege, they have to work that mm-hmm. by dividing mm-hmm. the people behind mm-hmm. Sanders and the insurgency there and the insurgency that is the Black Lives Matter movement mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the Trump white working class. And you can mm-hmm. see in the organizing efforts that are going on or whatever that the Clinton campaign, the Democratic Party, and the elites of both parties – see that as job one. They have to provoke incidents with Trump. They have to portray mm-hmm. the voters behind Trump as racists and Neanderthals mm-hmm. and all of that. Mm-hmm. How do you combat that and instead stitch them together so that you can empower this, you know, the working class in essence? Mm-hmm. Those are the mm-hmm. elements of the working mm-hmm. class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the first thing is you have to have confidence in ordinary working people, that given the opportunity, and especially in a moment like this, that their experiences can help them to draw certain conclusions. You know, that's the first thing. The second thing we have to acknowledge, even within these great movements of insurgency, there is unevenness. Everyone is not on the same page. There are more advanced elements. They're less advanced elements. The other thing is that we cannot substitute subjectivism and subjectivity and even dogmatism for an objective, scientific, even ethnographic understanding and study of what's going on the ground. What's going on the ground? And this is across the world, especially in the advanced capitalist countries, is that the working people the working class is being immiserated, impoverished, unemployed, social services cut, health care cut, and so on. Brexit was a moment, an important moment, in a working class rejection of the political elites that brought us neoliberal globalization and the financialization of the world economy. Now, I think that we, out of all of this, must come forward not just with a plan to unite, but with a program that speaks to the basic needs of the working people and the middle class and the young and the imprisoned and the impoverished as a whole, a program that unites. And I would say, first and foremost, we have to talk about a jobs and infrastructure and clean energy, massive trillion, multi-trillion dollar program over a decade. That is the first thing. We have to put America back to work. The second thing, a rejection of all of these neoliberal trade agreements that have impoverished not only workers in the United States, but all over the world, and intends to even intensify that. The third thing is we have to shut down the big banks. We have to call upon the government to take over the big banks, break them up, that the Federal Reserve becomes and the Treasury Department become instruments, if they can. I don't know, maybe they can't be, but if they can, that monetary financial policy become instruments of empowering the people. I heard one economist refer to it as quantitative easing for the people. Yeah. And I would say from that, a number of other issues concerning the police, breaking up these militarized police departments all around the country, criminalizing the criminals on the police force rather than the masses of poor and working class black and brown people. So I think we have to come forward with such a program, not that we impose it from above upon movements, but we connect it organically to the movements that are out there already.
And of course, we could do that with foreign policy as well. There's your money.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I'm sorry to have omitted that. Yes.
And, you know, looking at the international scene, I think it's interesting while we're sitting here contemplating what kind of wrecking work basically is going to be done to divide the working class here. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that in France, where first they elected a socialist government in the midst of this crisis, and, you know, replacing Sarkozy with Hollande, and then suddenly, and then the people are in the streets in France like nobody's business. That is the most active working class rebellion on the planet right now. There's three major terrorist attacks in the past year, year and a half: Charlie Hebdo, Paris, and now Nice. You know, I'm wondering if we're going to be looking at something like that here as, you know, an attempt to make certain that the working class remains divided instead of, you know, trying to unite with a program.
Yeah, I think it's very, very possible. And we have to be ideologically and politically prepared for it. You know, one of the things that's so clear in France is even with these successive terrorist attacks upon ordinary citizens. And you know, that kind of suggests something. You know, why do you punish unarmed, ordinary people? Suggesting something, but those kinds of provocations do not enhance the political standing of unpopular governments with their people. For instance, Hollande, his ratings are, what, about 9%? And they do not go up, even though he gives these so-called anti-terrorist speeches and imposes states of emergency. And even in the state of emergency, millions of French working people and young people are in the streets. You know, again, it you get these colliding tendencies within world history. The West's foreign policy and actual direct on the ground actions lead to the rise of Al-Qaeda, of ISIS, of terrorism, which always attacks ordinary people, does not attack or regimes or governments that are not in line with the West or NATO, never attacks the centers of power. So it's obviously a form of terrorism that comes from the right and not from the people. I think that we have to look at these things very carefully. We have to be prepared for it here. You know, there are going to be thousands of people marching in Cleveland and in Philadelphia. The ground is very fertile for all kinds of provocation because the movements are not yet ideologically or organizationally set up to handle such provocation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we have to be prepared for that, I would say.
And finally, going into Cleveland this coming Monday, as the media attempts to caricature the white working class that is there to support Trump, as ignorant, racist, bigoted, and basically something to be feared, fascists. How do you counter that effort by, you know, showing the actual character of it to people? And how do you get people who have been stirred up because of a justifiable reaction to the history of things that, look, these are the people that you need to work with, or else you're going to lose.
Well, you know, I prefer a Bernie Sanders over both Clinton and Trump. However, or, you know, I would say I prefer Jill Stein over all of them.
Right.
But the real deal is that we're dealing with a proven threat to humanity and a brinksmanship politician in Hillary Clinton. There is no question about it. On international policy, Trump runs to the left of Clinton. Now, that doesn't make him the answer to the problems of war and peace. But he somehow is calling for what is a detente, a pullback from brinksmanship and aggression. Therefore, this equation or mantra that Clinton is the neoliberal and Trump is the neo-fascist does not fit the objective conditions. It might, you know, fulfill certain subjective, emotional needs to make sense of a world in transition, but that's not the reality. On trade and trade deals and neoliberal globalization, Trump is to the left of Clinton. On race, Hillary Clinton shares one thing, but has been associated with the most violent structural racism that we can imagine. However, Trump does not give us or the working class the type of discourse which diffuses and helps to lead white working and middle class people out of their morass of white supremacy and anti-black racism. Now, so therefore, I think that the target of our ideological and political efforts going forward must be Hillary Clinton, and they must be anti-Hillary Clinton. And then, and that means up to the convention, I think this is an important moment. These next 2 weeks here in Philadelphia are going to be very, very important because, again, it is not an absolute certainty that Clinton will be the nominee. She might withdraw on her own or under pressure, but Clinton must be the target. At the same time, we cannot be unmindful of the rise of fascist, skinhead, Nazi forces who do not have a mass base and can only rely upon provocation and embedding themselves in the white working class and attempting to appear to be the spokespersons of the interests of the white working class. I think that that the answer, again, is that we must go deep into the working class. We must come forward with a program of unity, both in domestic policy and jobs creation and infrastructure and clean energy building, a type of 21st century W Works Project Administration, a 21st century New Deal. People say the government is in so much debt. How do you finance that? Well, you take the money from where it's at. It's in the bank, you know, and just like you have quantitative easing for the 1%. Well, let's think about quantitative easing for the majority of us. I think there's a way ahead, but we have to have the courage and the ideological clarity to go forward and not to be paralyzed by the, the provocation of the media. And we cannot accept stereotypes of either black people, Latino people, or white working people. We have to have objective evidence. And I think we only get that by being with working people, being in conversation with working people, and helping to solve the political, ideological, and organizational issues confronting the working people at this time.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. It's going to be very interesting in Cleveland next week and Philadelphia the week after.
Indeed.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host. And look forward to seeing you again next week.